Hello, I'm Dr. Burton Clark. Welcome to Leadership on the Line. Today's show is on critical infrastructure protection. We will be discussing how to protect fire departments, police departments, and EMS operations to make sure they are always ready and capable to respond when called, no matter what. Today's national panel of leaders to discuss CIP are Dave Paulson, Administrator of the U.S. Fire Administration at the Department of Homeland Security, Sergeant Andy Gillespie, Indianapolis Police Department in Indiana, and Chief Chuck Warner, the Charlottesville Fire Department in Virginia. Welcome, gentlemen. Chief Paulson, can you explain what critical infrastructure protection means to the fire service?
Well, one of the issues with the fire service we've seen around the world is the propensity for terrorists to use the fire department as weapons, the fire equipment and also the uniforms and other issues inside the fire service. So protecting the fire department is taking care of your equipment. One of the examples that I used is I walked into a fire station last week, and there was a truck sitting in the apparatus bay, nobody around, and I walked around the truck. It was one of the ones we bought from the grant. And the keys were sitting in the truck, and the bay doors were open. And I could have easily just gotten in that truck and took off and drove it around the block and put explosives in it and driven anywhere I wanted to go in the country. So the fire service needs to protect their equipment. They need to make sure that they're secure. And at the same time, they also need to look at protecting their firefighters. Here in the National Capital Region, all the fire departments around here have purchased two sets of turnout gear for all of their firefighters. So if something gets contaminated, they can quickly move them into a second set of turnout gear and still be ready to respond instead of being incapacitated. It's a whole series of things of protecting our first responders. Because if they can't respond, if they're injured themselves, then they're of no use to the public.
I appreciate that, Chief. Sergeant Gillespie, what does CIP mean to police departments?
It's similar, as Chief Paulson has said. It's protecting what's truly critical to all the law enforcement agencies, in order to perform the function and the mission to protect the community. To start, we'd ask who are our key personnel, both within our agency as well as our community. All of our people are critical, but do we have a plan in place to ensure our key decision makers are able to function? A specific proactive police example would be identifying key leaders in the community, such as a governor of a state or a mayor of a major city. Then we'd assign law enforcement officers or agents that would be tasked to provide a dignitary protection to determine, based on the risk, to ensure that they're in place and ready to make decisions. Other considerations would be to identify the physical assets that the police need to function, such as our facilities, our communication center, cyber systems, radio, police cruisers, and ensuring that they're all ready to go with a lot of redundancy. This is especially critical for police because we typically don't stay in one place very long. We spend much of our time driving around the community, scanning and responding to disruptions in the normal day-to-day living already. So at a tactical level, we might have a SIP plan in place where an officer would be asked to do a windshield survey of government, healthcare, economic, geographic critical assets and report their status to our emergency operations center. This is not to mention the other critical missions of intelligence gathering or investigations as determined by the Attorney General. In summary, it's spending a little bit of time and effort to ensure our police service will be able to respond.
Thank you. Chief Warner, how does the EMS community view critical infrastructure protection?
Well, I think we're all singing off the same song sheet. Basically, it's the same thing that's already been mentioned. Key is protecting our people both from the vulnerabilities that we identify through the training and the equipment that they need to do the job. It also means protecting our facilities, our fire stations, our EMS stations, our hospitals, to make sure that they're protected as well from vulnerabilities. And we have to do so in such a way that we maintain a balance, that we don't exclude ourselves so much from the public that we become such secure facilities that we can't function as we have in the past, while taking those precautions, as Administrator Paulson had mentioned earlier about the security of the vehicles being used as improvised explosive devices. What we have done here is we've added some tamper mechanisms in place on the apparatus that require you to do something else to start the apparatus instead of just some of the normal procedures, so that the general person who comes in off the street or a terrorist who tries to take over a vehicle would not necessarily be able to do that. In addition to that, it's about systems, our communications, computer-aided dispatch. We're much more reliant now, especially in tactical operations, on technology to make sure that we have strategies in place to cover all those issues and build in redundancy. The key thing that I'd like to add to what everything has been said so far is I think the key to us managing our critical infrastructure protection for EMS and all the other aspects is that we work together as we are today, speaking from a fire and EMS, a law enforcement standpoint, and develop very strong relationships to where we are sharing information and working collectively.
Super. Thank you very much. Chief Gillespie, critical infrastructure protection is concerned with people, physical assets, and systems. Tell us about the people aspect of CIP.
Well, as Chief Werner just mentioned, the most important of all critical infrastructures of any organization begin with its people. Our people, regardless of the rank, are the foremost part of our function. We can give them the best equipment, the biggest fire trucks, the latest technology, the best plans, but if we don't have healthy, well-trained, competent people with high morale, nothing else really matters. We have to ask the question, if disaster happens, what can we do to protect them in order for them to still be able to do their jobs? So our greatest consideration has to be toward protecting our responders and the people that lead them.
Okay. Chief Paulson, give us an example or explain the physical assets that CIP is concerned with.
Well, we've talked about most of them, you know, protecting our stations, protecting our equipment, our turnout gear, and obviously our first responders, firefighters, police, and EMS. But one of the things also we need to start doing as individual cities and communities is working together with the police department, the fire department, EMS, our local politicians, and working, and I use the phrase standing shoulder to shoulder, identifying the critical infrastructures in the city that's maybe just outside the police and fire department assets, the ones that are going to shut down your city, the ones that are going to shut down your departments, and together work on those of how we're going to protect those, how we're going to respond to them, and looking very carefully at what the consequences are if you lose that particular critical infrastructure inside your city. But we have to do it together. The fire department can't do it alone. The police department can't do it alone, and neither can EMS or the emergency managers. We have to do it as a team. And what I'm recommending is each city put together a team and identify those critical infrastructures that are in the city, and together decide how you're going to protect them and then how you're going to respond to them if something does happen.
Thanks. Chief Werner, the people and the things are probably the easy part of this CIP concept, but talk for a minute about the systems that critical infrastructure tries to secure.
Well, the systems that we're using now in technology specifically, we're seeing a lot more that's available to us that's affordable now that was perhaps not in the past. Our computer systems, our records management systems, all the cyber things that we work with. And we've seen recently, if you've watched the news, that we've been under attack, not necessarily from terrorists per se, but from hackers in general. So that just shows our vulnerability already for some systems that we're becoming much more dependent upon. Computer-aided dispatch, our communication systems themselves are very much cyber-based because they're linked a lot by different types of technology and computer-based things. So as we use these systems more often and become more dependent, we have to make sure that strategies are in place to overcome them. And the planning for that is now, not when something happens.
Thank you. Chief Werner, is the focus of CIP on terrorism, or is it intended for an all-hazards prevention, protection, and response concept?
Well, I think that our lessons have been learned that while terrorism is certainly something we have to prepare ourselves for, that we are going to be more often stricken by the fires that kill more people per year than that happen to die in the World Trade Center repeatedly. The people that are injured and the damage that's caused by floods, earthquakes, mudslides, tornadoes, hurricanes, and so on. So I guess I would say that it depends on how we define terrorism, because I would think some of those things might be considered terrorism because they terrorize us much more than domestic or foreign. But if we prepare for all hazards, we will certainly be prepared for the terrorism that would occur either domestically or internationally.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Sergeant Gillespie, what information is available to state and local authorities to help them address all the critical infrastructure protection issues?
Well, one of the key goals to this webcast were to raise awareness of the SIP program and encourage members of the emergency service sector to subscribe to the information that's available on disasterhelp.gov. So I'd encourage the listeners to this broadcast to seek and sign up and get involved with the Emergency Management Response Information Sharing and Analysis Center and subscribe to interest for their community and their interest, particular area of EMS, law enforcement, or fire protection.
Can you give us a little description of the kinds of things that are available through that center?
Yeah, they have a introductory brochure that basically outlines the what is available as far as what is CIP and why is it important. If you're making the presentation to members of the community, you should have an explanation, also a job aid that goes through it. It provides a pretty detailed architecture and matrix where you can go through a decision process as far as what critical infrastructure protection is and how you can adapt it to your community.
Okay. Talk for a minute a little bit about the whole subscription service that's available on through that system.
If you go on to disasterhelp.gov, you can request a secure logon. It's a pretty advanced system, and really impressed with what you all have done with that to make it available for us to be able to share information and get real-time information and chat and communicate with our other members of the emergency services sector. So go on to disasterhelp.gov, and there's a box at the upper right-hand corner, I believe, that explains on how to log on, get a secure log on, and then going through the pamphlets and the brochures is how to use the system.
That's great. Thank you. Chief Paulson, what do you tell police chiefs, fire chiefs, and EMS directors that say, I don't have the time or money to worry about critical infrastructure, and besides, nothing bad will happen in my community?
Well, my position is you can't afford not to do it. There is not a, in terrorism aside, there is not a city in this country that doesn't have some type of natural disaster that could occur in their area. And as Chief Warner pointed out, that critical infrastructure protection is not just terrorism. It's about all hazards, whether it's a hurricane or tornado or floods or anything else. You have to be able to protect that, because if you lose that, then you don't have the capacity or the capability of protecting those you're sworn to serve. So there is no excuse where I don't have the time or money. The answer is that we have to find a way to do it, and by working together, again, with police and fire and EMS and all the leaders of the community, we can identify those critical infrastructures, and we can find a way to protect them and also then prepare to respond to them.
That's great. Thanks. Gentlemen, just to close out this first half hour of the show, I'll just ask for some final comments from you about this whole concept of critical infrastructure protection from your point of view, looking at it from a national level. Chief Paulson, what would you share with our audience today?
Well, if there was one thing I had, again, to share is that you have to do it together. You have to do it as a community. The lines that we have traditionally drawn between police and fire and EMS cannot continue on. We don't have the time for that. We are one group. We are all sworn to protect our community, and we have to continue and start working together in a more robust manner. We are one team. We're in the same boat together. So that would be my single most message to all of the first responders out there.
I appreciate that, Chief. Chief Warner, what closing ideas would you leave with our audience?
I think to dovetail on Administrator Paulson's message is that it's all about relationships. Is that we all need to work with, get to know, and develop very strong relationships between not only our fire, EMS, and law enforcement components, but our health departments, our schools, our public works, all of those non-public safety entities that are mission critical, to develop a really strong bond that when it really gets bad, that we're all ready to deal with it together.
Thank you. And Sergeant Gillespie, you get the final word for this first part of the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's unusual for a police officer to be invited to such dignified leaders as Chief Paulson and Chief Warner and yourself. And the fact that you're involving the police department and in this program, I'm most grateful for, and it shows that you're truly committed to serving the country and the community. So that would be it. Everything you've said is right on point, and I support it 100%.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you for your time and information. And we'll be back in a moment with the rest of our show.
Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go.
Welcome back to Leadership on the Line. Today's topic is critical infrastructure protection. I'm your host, Dr. Burton Clark. We are talking about protecting the people, physical assets, and systems that make fire, police, and EMS organizations work no matter what emergency or disaster strikes your community. The local leaders to discuss these CIP topics are Police Chief David Moore from Laurel, Maryland, Battalion Chief Greg Locker, Special Operations Homeland Security Bureau, Toledo, Ohio Fire Rescue, and our special international guest, Deputy Chief Fire Officer Jaktar Singh from Bedfordshire Luton Fire Rescue Service in England. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Gentlemen, you've been listening to our national experts on critical infrastructure protection. Now, let's talk about the local rank and file where the rubber meets the road and the work gets done. Chief Moore, what threats have you identified in Laurel that could impact your police personnel, and what countermeasures have you put into place?
Dr. Clark, we're in a very unique situation here in Laurel in that we're located approximately 20 minutes outside of the district in Washington, D.C., 20 minutes to the north is Baltimore City, and then, of course, we have Annapolis about 18 miles to the east. Although we have a population in Laurel proper of probably 20,000 people, we normally see about 185,000 folks during the day, and a lot of that is mass transit. So that would certainly be high on our high-profile threat assessment list, is basically the mass transit situation, our MARC trains, our Metro bus line, also our connector ride. And so we see a tremendous amount of individuals coming through from Baltimore to the district, for example. We have a large amount of freight trains that come through containing hazardous materials on a daily basis. And here locally, we do have several fuel depots, which are very large in nature, right inside of the city. But more importantly, though, I believe we have the Rocky Gorge Dam, which really is about 2 miles to the west of the city. And if there were a potential problem, certainly that would be one that would impact everyone living in a community.
Sure. Now, just sort of follow-up, Chief, you mentioned all the train systems that go through Laurel. It's
yes.
A major hub. And after the Spain bombings, where they had one explosion and one after another, and then the same one happened in Great Britain, you know, what special kind of countermeasures did you take that you can share with us to protect the police officers that might be responding into a scene like that?
One thing that we're attempting to do, we have set aside, fortunately our city fathers have given us some money specifically to deal with these type of measures in the way of overtime, for example. We immediately called out on-call officers to actually go in uniform and work in the areas around our metro system. Now, we're also continually training with our fire EMS, and we do have equipment available for our officers should something happen here in the immediate area. So a lot of that is just based on the training that we've had with all of our public safety officials here over the last several months. So that's one thing that we're trying to do is just keep a high-profile presence in and around these areas, these sites.
Well, thank you. Chief Locker, what have you done to secure the EMS physical assets in your department?
Well, as our national leadership just presented, the physical assets are just one component of critical infrastructure protection. In Toledo, Ohio, the Toledo Fire and Rescue Department, in cooperation with the Public Health and Public Works Departments, used the guidelines very similar to the FEMA document, the Fire and Emergency Service Preparedness Guide for Homeland Security Advisory System, where we use a graduated response to the threat level. At threat level orange, we begin to do things on Toledo Fire and Rescue, such as securing all our stations, making sure that we keep a track of who visitors are coming into the stations, and doing things with some vehicle security issues, such as not leaving them unattended at emergency incidents, and doing things such as going around the vehicle after an incident to make sure that nothing's been tampered with. In addition to the, then that goes up at a level red procedure. In addition to the to this, we've also had to go outside the fire department and look at what is critical for our mission, our mission essential equipment. And there are things that we've discovered, such as our communications equipment. We've developed some redundant communications equipment, and then we begin to protect the ones that we have in place through a variety of means, primarily by parking is prohibited around some of the communication towers, and we begin to monitor them. Then the other issue is, of course, water supply for the fire site. We have identified the critical locations within the county that are required for us to maintain an adequate water supply. Then, of course, not to leave this out, but the rigs won't work if we don't have gasoline and proper maintenance. So we've hardened some assets there on an everyday basis. And then, again, it goes up as the threat levels go from orange to red.
How about a simple thing like was mentioned in the first half of the show about putting special devices on ambulances to make sure a general citizen couldn't start it? I mean, have you thought about or done those kinds of things just on your ambulances?
Yes, as a matter of fact, in Toledo, we operate our ALS on a countywide basis. And just to reinforce, this doesn't have to be a terrorist. What drove this several years ago was a life squad was stolen from a left running at a hospital, ER, and was stolen. After that, we took a look at that, clearly identified the vulnerability, and we have anti-tamper switches installed on all the rigs, and standard operating procedures are now to, of course, shut the rigs off so that they can't be started.
Great. Chief Singh, it's your turn. Again, thank you very much for being my first international guest. This is really great that you're willing to participate.
Well, good afternoon, Bert, and good morning to everyone over there.
How have you protected your fire brigade? You don't call them fire departments over there. You do call them fire brigades.
Yes, I think you got the term right, yes.
How do you protect your fire brigade's systems to ensure they work no matter what happens?
Well, first of all, it might be worthwhile me just putting into a picture of the structure in the UK. In England, our fire departments work to a national standard, which is controlled by the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, where we have a uniformed inspectorate that makes sure that we have certain standards. Also, our funding arrangements are different in that some of our funding comes from the national government and some of it comes from local government. So as far as our systems are concerned, following September the 11th, what we have looked at is due to the changes in legislation on civil contingencies, we've looked at the risk critical areas of our business, and as already pointed out early on in our first broadcast, the systems that are most vulnerable are our computer systems and our mobilizing systems. We've put a significant amount of investment in there from national government into secure going moving from what was 48 control centers for mobilization down to 8, and that's going to happen over the next 3 to 4 years, which is going to ensure that we have the resilience within those control centres to manage any kind of major incidents, and also has the resilience to be protected from any kind of external attack. Currently what we have is we would have secondary controls in our fire departments, and if they were unable to cope, we have arrangements with our neighbouring fire department to pick up those calls. We also have systems in place so that if there's any incident that requires large numbers of staff for a call of duty, we have a legal structural arrangements where fire brigades from neighboring brigades can make over-the-border arrangements, come and support us. There are political structures in place also for collaborating in partnership to ensure that we have the training in place, we have the planning in place to ensure any kind of incident, whether it's a terrorist activity or a natural disaster, we're ready to cope with that. We've also recognized that with the use, more and more use of mobile phones, that we need to be able to secure their mobile phone networks, which we're now also able to do. And there is also a national structure coming into place now called FireLink, which will ensure that all of our communication structures are also secure.
Wow. Just out of curiosity, Chief, on your apparatus, do you actually have data terminals like laptop computers or that are linked back?
It really depends how advanced the fire brigade is that you're working with. Majority of fire brigades are now moving into mobile data transmission systems. My brigade has one of those systems, which is able to download previous information that you had around for fire safety legislation, where you've got plans of buildings, where you've got plans of how you would deal with those incidents in the early stages, ability to transmit information about hazardous materials. So, yes, a number of brigades are moving to that, and with the new structure that I've just explained with regional control rooms, all brigades will have that in the future.
Now, I guess I'm not a technical person, but do you use the worldwide internet for your platform, or is it a special secure system?
It'll be a secure system, which I alluded to earlier, which will be called FireLink.
Oh, great. Excellent. Thank you. Okay, this next question is for all three of you. I'd ask you to give us an example of an event that occurred in your community that illustrates the need for critical infrastructure protection, and just be as specific as you can, if you don't mind. Chief Locker, do you have one?
Sure do. We were responsible. We had the dubious distinction of being responsible for the blackout that occurred several years ago. It extended to up and down the entire eastern coast. That was our local energy company that where the process began. And what that illustrated to us was several things. The event took place, fortunately, in the middle of the afternoon, where most of our command staff was able to immediately respond. And once we began to realize the scope of the blackout problem, we had pre-identified, because of the Y2K problem several years ago, critical infrastructures that needed to be get up and running immediately, such as water supply. One thing that we did in the state of Ohio was to enact the Ohio Fire Chief's response plan, because we did lose some of our critical pumping stations, and municipal fire departments don't have water tankers to haul water around. So we had to get mutual aid in from throughout the state to a city such as Cleveland to assist there. Radio channels and communications became an issue in that it temporarily dropped out our radio system, and we had to go to a redundant communication system. The after-action review revealed some problems there with our individual stations. It wasn't a practice thing of switching over to that alternate radio frequency. So now once a month we practice that and intentionally take the radio system down to that lower level. And of course, cell phones were immediately knocked out, and so what we've done is instituted redundant communications amongst our command staff and leadership within the city of Toledo, using alternate technology for that, from a variety of things, using talk groups on cell phones, which will stay stable, to satellite phones, so that we can stay in touch there. This illustrates what Chief Paulson tried to say. It was not a terrorism event. It was an all-hazards approach to this, in that it's not necessarily a terrorist event that's going to take you out here that you have to be prepared for.
That's great. Chief Singh, do you have a story you can tell us?
Yes, I'd just like to reiterate what Chief Mutcher said. The examples that I've got from the UK are predominantly examples around natural disasters. And what I'm going to do is, instead of giving you one example, I'll give you four so that people can go into Google search and have a look at those. The first incident was last year at a plastics factory in Glasgow, where the new resilience vehicles were used for the first time, and it showed the approach to having a national approach for major incidents. The second incident is Bowcastle, where there was major flooding in Devon, which needed to utilise the new vehicles that we'd brought in for floods and the like. The next one was earlier this year in Cumbria, where again there was massive flooding. And the final one, I think many of your listeners will be well aware of, is the terrorist bombings in London, which demonstrated very clearly that the learning that we'd got from September the 11th incident, and managing incidents spread over a large area where large numbers of people need to be dealt with, can be coordinated from a central source, such as a regional control room. So those are four real good examples of how, if you plan for major activities, major disasters, and you've got the structures and systems in place, then you can deal with almost any eventuality.
And there are stories about those incidents on the web?
There would be, yeah. There'd be. If anybody wanted to email me, I could either download some information for them. But on the Google search, if you put Factory Fire Glasgow 2004, Bocastle Floods Devon, floodings in Cumbria, or obviously the terrorist bombings in London 7th of 11, a whole host of information will be available.
That's great. Chief Moore, can you tell us about an event in Laurel?
Yes, there are actually a few events I'd like to share with you. First, the most obvious that I think got most of the headlines is the information sharing pre 9/11, when we had actually 9 of the 19 terrorists living in or around the city of Laurel. The federal government was conducting surveillance for several days at many locations during that time. Very much a breakdown in communications. No notification to the city, to our personnel. As a result, a large number of false alarms took place, which wasted a tremendous amount of our resources. But then a few years ago, we did actually have a very devastating tornado that came through our city. And it lasted approximately 4 days, the event. And it certainly was a very tremendous situation on all of our resources, the cleanup and the recovery situation. And the past incident I wanted to mention, the very last one, was a freight train derailment just outside of our city borders, which took a tremendous amount of resources. And I do believe that it would be very much appropriate to have a critical infrastructure program in place for all of those types of incidents.
Very good. Appreciate that, Chief. Chief Locker, tell us how you've used the Critical Infrastructure Protection Process Job Aid in your community.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the blackout really drove us to look at some things that outside our own system here of mission-critical equipment and assets. And so our bureau, along with the law enforcement and public health people and public works people, received a mandate from our mayor to develop essentially a business continuity plan for every department within the city of Toledo. And the problem there is that we're not familiar with their particular critical assets, so to speak, that or infrastructures that they have. And so we used the Critical Infrastructure Job Aid, went to each director within the city of Toledo and identified their critical infrastructures within their own department, determined any threat that could be possible against those, looked at the vulnerabilities of those threatened infrastructures, and then assess the risk of them. And we found significant numbers that there were the obvious ones, of course, such as the IT people and our computers. That one was pretty obvious. But there were some other ones that were not so obvious to us that were at risk where we really needed to have those records to keep government running if an event happened. We're in a unique situation here in Toledo in that our local government offices are in a structure that's combined with city, state, and county government. So if we lose that one building, we lose a pretty important asset in general. And so what we did with each department director was have them, in addition to this business continuity plan that assisted them drawing up, we had to apply countermeasures where the risk wasn't acceptable and provide measures for them to keep their assets running. So we started out by giving them the job aid that is published by the Critical Infrastructure Protection and then walked them through those five steps that I just went through.
That's great. Without giving away any secrets, can you give us an example of a countermeasure?
Certainly. There are records that are essential to keeping government running, and those records were stored in one location within the building. So if we lose that building, which, by the way, is a very attractive target, not only for terrorists, but for if we had such as was mentioned here, a tornado go through and damage that building, that we would lose those records. So as simple as backing up the records at an alternate location for them to have access to, and then move their operations to that an alternate location would be an example.
Great. Chief Moore, how has the Critical Infrastructure Protection Information Sharing System helped in Laurel, Maryland?
I'll tell you, over the last year or so, it's been tremendous. The Chief just mentioned attractive targets, for example. And I think it's given us an opportunity to actually spread out. We have some very attractive targets. Fort Meade and the National Security Agency sit right outside of our borders. So we're doing a lot more of internal training with the other resources and pre-planning for responses to several different types of incidents that could take place. One thing we're doing in the Prince George's County region, there is 27 different police agencies, and we're doing a much more effective job doing memos of understanding so that we can get rid of those borders that really alienate us and have previously. And I think we're doing a great job because we have a very good structure in place with critical infrastructure.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that, Chief. Chief Singh, talk a minute about the time and money that the UK has invested in critical infrastructure protection, and also what you think the return on that investment is.
Well, first of all, I think it's difficult to capture all the time because a great deal of energy and time has been spent all around the country with not only senior officers but government officials and also other key stakeholders looking very carefully at their structures and their policies and procedures to ensure that any kind of disaster, whether it's natural or terrorist-made, can be met. But following September 11th, one of the key things that I was talking about earlier is that a national project's been set up, which is called New Dimensions, and it defines resilience as the ability to manage disruptive challenges such as terrorist attacks, whether it's chemical, biological, radiological, or major flooding. And it's taken some very practical steps so that fire brigades can manage the incidents effectively and respond effectively quickly, as well as also preventing those incidents from occurring in the first place. We've also had from government a new Fire Service Act of 2004, which places new responsibilities on the Fire and Rescue Service. The government has given us nearly over £188 million just for equipment alone. That equipment focuses on mass decontamination. It is provided as an additional responsibility for urban search and rescue. It's provided as high-volume pumps. It's given us new command and control structures. It's given us a new command and control rooms. It's also given us that filing project that I talked to you about earlier. We now also have large hose layers which can go across borders to support fire brigades. So in all, it's been a sort of holistic approach to the whole process. To say it's been invested about £300 million would be probably underestimating it. But there has been significant investment. And the end result, I think the successful way in which UK fire brigades have dealt with those incidents I pointed out earlier is the outcome for the community, because it's really about protecting the community and providing them with a safer community, and also being able to respond quickly to their needs.
Oh, I appreciate that. All right, John, we're getting close to the end of the show. Chief Locker, do you have a final comment that you'd like to share with our audience?
I sure do. 2 points, just to follow up on both Chief Moore's and Chief Singh's. I think it's important that the fire service and EMS service look at this from a regional approach, not just the city or municipality approach, but look at it from a countywide approach, because as they pointed out, you've got critical infrastructures that are going to be affected outside your own border that could be affect your operations, and it'll also help you provide a much more smoother transition, as I mentioned through our mutual aid response plan earlier. And the second, to follow up on what Chief Paulson said earlier, this is about relationships. The relationships that you're going to develop in doing this planning are critical, because the relationships are how you're going to learn how other people think and how they respond to disasters. To give you an example, we recently had a rather catastrophic fire, an explosion at a grain elevator here in town, and there was only one small volunteer department from the next county over that happened to have some foam that we didn't know the leadership involved in, and they responded to this. We had military response to this. We had a variety of multi-agency responses to this, and the relationships that we've built through the previous planning is what got us through that incident. You can't plan for everything. The plan's going to fall apart, and when the plan falls apart, it's the relationships that'll get you through it.
I appreciate that, Chief. Chief Moore, what closing comments would you share with our audience?
Yes, I would only state also that I certainly agree with Chief Locker that we really need to share our resources. We can't stand alone in an emergency. I know that we've had natural disasters here where we did feel like we were on our own, and it was a tremendous letdown because we didn't have those critical resources in place. I do believe that as we move forward to protect our communities, we absolutely have to have those roundtables, you know, those discussions, those practicals, and that should be local, state, and federal also. All of those agencies pulling those resources together, and I think you'll see a successful operation for whether it's a terrorist act or man-made.
I appreciate that. And Chief Singh, you get the final comment because you're probably the most experienced with this, with all the issues that have faced the UK over the last decade.
Well, Bert Clark, thank you very much, first of all, for organizing this webcast. It's been a great opportunity. And as always, by taking part, I've learned an awful lot from our partners in the United States. I think Chief Moore and Chief Locker have made most of the critical points that I would like to make. This is all about partnerships. It's about identifying the key stakeholders. And they won't always be the blue lights organizations. So we've got to look wider than what we've looked at in the past. It's about sharing of knowledge, and we've just done that by sharing it not only locally but also internationally. For us, it's also about government support and getting that government engagement and getting the financial support that we need to meet the community needs. And finally, what I would agree with Chief Locker is that, yes, this is about relationships. Whenever we do exercises, that's what we're doing. We're building our relationships. And of course, if you plan, you exercise, review, when the day comes, it should all go well.
Chief, I appreciate that. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. During the past hour, the discussion intended to raise awareness of critical infrastructure protection. CIP is the process used to protect our emergency personnel, our physical assets, and our communication systems. By applying a small investment of time and money to the application of CIP principles, we can ensure our organizational response ability in an all-hazards environment. To acquire CIP information that affects the plans and operations of emergency response organizations, sign up to receive free of charge information from the Emergency Management and Response Information Sharing and Analysis Center. The website is https://disasterhelp.gov/USFACIP.html. That information is also on your website. This is a secure location. Many of the documents disseminated to subscribers are published by the Department of Homeland Security and contain timely, important, and useful information regarding threats to and vulnerabilities of the emergency services sector. However, if you desire to communicate to the Emergency Management Response Information Sharing and Analysis Center, then you can send an email to emr-isac@dhs.gov. If you're online, you can see these email addresses and URLs on your screen. This has been Leadership on the Line. I'm Dr. Burton Clark. Thanks for listening.